Afternoon, everybody. Try that out. There we go. How's the conference going so far? It's good. All right. Well, welcome to my session. It's called It's Getting Cloudy. My name is Mark Krasinovich. I'll just stop here for a second and tell you about who I am and what I'm doing here at Microsoft. I joined Microsoft about 5 years ago, and about a year and a half ago, I switched out of the Windows team, which I'd been working on after I joined Microsoft, and went to the Windows Azure team. And this talk is all about the cloud, and I'm going to be talking about the cloud in general terms, but I'll also be reinforcing some of the things I talk about with what we've been doing in Azure and some of the lessons we've learned in Windows Azure. And the cool thing about being in Windows Azure at this point, after spending all my career up to that point really focusing on desktop server operating systems, is that now I'm focused on what we call a data center, and actually we like to strive to make it a geo operating system, an operating system that manages servers across the world, not just an individual server. And the challenges here range from very small, down, very low level kind of challenges, like how do we boot VMs really quickly on the same server, to high level things like what should the application model look like when we start to bring in descriptions of other resource types, like SQL Azure and other resources that we've got coming up as middleware services in the cloud, and we want people to declaratively be able to create applications that use those resources. And so it gives me this opportunity to work all across the stack. And the really cool thing I think about this, though, is that this is a new world and there's lots of questions. We're all, just like Microsoft is working on this, there's other people working on it, and we're all coming up and running into problems at the same kinds of problems and addressing them, having to come up with new ways to look at the problem and solve the problems. So this is, it's kind of like being really here at the early wave of a wave, which is exactly leads me into my first slide here, which is about computing epochs. And I think that this is kind of obvious to most people, so I'll move through this preliminary material pretty quickly, but this reinforces the fact that I think I'm at the right place at the right time here at Microsoft on the Windows Azure team. And that's that we've really seen three, I think, phases or epochs of computing. The first one started with mainframes and dumb clients. That you have your WISE terminal connected up to a mainframe running workloads from other users of typically the same organization, and serving that out over screens that people type into. All the computing happens back in the mainframe. And then as I was actually coming out of high school, or in high school, coming out of high school, that transition, I caught this wave, and that's what got me interested in computers. That was the client-server wave. This is where the Apple II and the IBM PC wave, which really put computing power in the hands of individuals and really changed the world, the way that we looked at computing, and created this company that I'm speaking at right now. We're at this next wave now, the cusp of it, which I think is actually even bigger than the first two in terms of the size and the magnitude of effect it's going to have on the world, and that is this mobile plus cloud phase that we're going to. And the word cloud is a word that you hear everybody talk about. Everybody throws it around. You're not cool unless you're talking about the cloud, and you've heard about a little bit about the cloud here, but I want to just motivate what I personally view as what the cloud is, what the essence of the cloud is, what I think that we like to deliver to people when we talk about cloud computing. And to do that, I want to highlight some of the different kinds of workloads that we see running on our cloud, because they really demonstrate some of the power of what you see on the cloud. These are large-scale workload patterns that previously were very difficult to account for, to build out for, to plan for, to adapt to. One of them is this one right here, which is from one of the companies that runs a bunch of stuff on Windows Azure called RiskMetrics. It's one of our largest customers in terms of number of compute cycles, number of VM instances. And what they do is a bunch of data analytics, where they capture a bunch of data, toss it up into the cloud, spin up a whole bunch of VMs that go process it, and then the processing's done, those VMs get all shut down. So it's a very on-off type of workload. This next type is actually from another application that's running on Windows Azure. This is docs.com, which is an add-in for Facebook, allows you to share Microsoft Office documents with people on Facebook. And that started out as an incubation from a lab we have called Fuse Labs, where they tossed it up, and it had a very quick spike in terms of usage as people started to hear about it and started to share documents. And so this is one where it started out with very few users, very little compute requirements, and then quickly jumped up as people started to toss documents, both in terms of compute and processing those documents as well as storage for those documents. This next one is another customer of ours, eBay, that runs certain auction software on Windows Azure. And as auction software and any kind of promotional stuff they do, which they also run apps for on the Windows Azure Cloud, these are very bursty types of workloads. If you've ever participated in eBay auction, you know that 99% of the bidding happens literally in the last few seconds before the item is done. And that's where you see the big spike in things. So very unpredictable bursting. They're not really sure when these spikes are going to take place, how big they're going to be, or how long they're going to be. And then this one's another customer of ours that runs promotional software and analytics software on us, Walmart, which is a very seasonal type of workload, where they see, of course, around the holiday times, as people start to do more buying, they'll see these apps start to require more resources. And then we've got even examples of our own workloads, currently not running on Windows Azure, perhaps one day in the future will be running on Windows Azure, and that's Bing, which has a daily fluctuation, which has this interesting characteristic that if you look across the world in terms of search, people are doing it at different times. So you see these bursts looked at from different perspectives that when you look at all up, create a pretty flat line in terms of usage, not perfectly flat line. That's searches in the UK versus searches in Japan, offset by roughly 12 hours. Now, you probably noticed that there's no y-axis on here, and that's because I think that'd be a little embarrassing. That top of the chart is really about 10,000, so not too many yet, but we hope that Bing catches up here in the future. Now, what is a cloud? This is my definition for cloud. And NIST has their own definition. I was just watching a keynote presentation from somebody else at a different conference giving their definition of cloud. So everybody's got little tweaks on their definitions. I like my definition the best. And I think this really captures from our perspective what we believe the cloud is. First of all, multi-tenant. And I think multi-tenant is key to any cloud because what you're getting out of the cloud is economics. You're getting economics out of the cloud in a few ways. One is basically it's not having to buy my own dedicated resources and then have them sit there unused if I don't have workload to put on them. If you look at those bursty kind of workloads, the different workload patterns, when I don't have load, then the resources would sit idle if they're my dedicated resources. But with multi-tenancy and what I call statistical over-provisioning or even allowing a certain number of customers to come on that have fixed size workloads and constant workloads that would utilize that resource, then we can make that resource available cheaply. Two ways. One is in terms of scale, because we can buy tons of it. It's going to cost Microsoft a lot less to buy their millionth server than it is going to be for you to buy your 10th server as you scale out. And the second is the statistical over-provisioning allows us to actually let more customers come onto the resources than you would be able to make use of yourself. So that Bing example was perfect case of if those were two different customers, we could actually pretty much put them on the same hardware and have that hardware fully utilized when each of them alone wouldn't be fully utilizing their resources by themselves. And the next few parts of this, self-service is key because if you look at traditional types of IT and provisioning of resources, it's not self-service. It's somebody needing to go call the IT shop and order a server. Spec the server out, spec the software out, wait for the order to come in, you know, probably bidding, POs filed, bidding, the shipping comes in, that gets into the IT shop. So it's all very much out of your control, whereas a key part of the cloud is that you can just go do it yourself. You don't have to involve somebody else. Scalable, of course, if you want to have a work resources that can adapt to the kind of workloads, you want it to be able to scale as you need it to scale. You want it not only to be able to scale, but to scale on demand. So I don't have to file another order to get a second server when my workload needs a second server and wait 3 months for that to come in and get set up and configured. Rather, I can just go click a button on my own that says I want another server. And then finally, compute and storage resources. And if you look at traditional server kind of provisioning, you get this chart that as companies are trying to predict their load as it comes in, they got to predict it with enough lead time and with enough accuracy to try to match the line as closely as possible. There's a couple problems with that. Is the lag makes it hard for you to predict what's, you know, 3 months. If it takes 3 months to get a server, what's my utilization going to look like in 3 months? I've got to take an educated guess there, and I could be off, up or down. I hope that I'm not below my guess. I hope that actually I have enough capacity to meet the demand. But at the same time, that demand might not be a constant demand. And so when it drops off, my resources are sitting there idle for some period of time, maybe even half a year if I've got kind of a seasonal workload. And then cloud provisioning, though, because of these characteristics, self-service, scalable, on-demand, I can scale my application very accurately to match the load curve. When utilization drops, I just simply scale to back my application. I give back those servers and put them back in the multi-tenant pool. When I want more, I just, on my own, through it programmatically or through a portal, self-service portal, I can just go say I want some more of them. And I think Scott Guthrie showed you a little bit of that. So that's really the motivation that I, as I see it, for cloud and the definition. I think for me, every single one of those terms in that definition is extremely important. When you talk about clouds and understand that part of it, then there's different flavors. And you've probably heard these different terms being thrown out about what cloud, different types of clouds. And some people say these terms are meaningless. It's not important that we have these definitions. But I still think that it's useful in some senses to talk about these. First, there's infrastructure as a service. This infrastructure as a service is essentially renting servers, and where you can stick your own virtual machines on those servers. You bring your own virtual machine image. You configure the virtual machine. You own the software in the virtual machine, including the operating system. It's basically really as if somebody else's data center, you're just renting CPUs on that data center. Example of this, of course, is EC2, introduced back in 2006. They are the guys that made infrastructure as a service and cloud computing, public cloud computing, really something that everybody understands now. Then you have platform as a service, and this is a different way of looking at the compute and storage resources. Instead of saying, we're just going to let you rent slices of physical resources, and you specify those slices, and then you get the resource, and it's pretty raw, you put your stuff on top of it. Rather, we're going to let you rent those resources with a layer that's going to help you out on top of that to help you make an application more quickly and let you not have to worry about that raw layer. We'll worry about it for you, and this is platform as a service. And if you took a look at what all the analysts are saying, they're all saying infrastructure as a service, that's a commodity. Really, the world is now about platform as a service. And this, is where Windows Azure is focused, is creating this runtime layer on top of the virtual machines so that you don't have to worry about the virtual machine, what's the virtual machines managing the operating system in the virtual machine. You bring your application, and because you bring an application program to the runtime, you get certain benefits, and I'm going to be talking about some of those benefits you get because the application model is designed for cloud applications. And you can see that there's a bunch of other companies that are into platform as a service, Google, App Engine, Salesforce.com, a couple of other examples. And then there's this other aspect, other type of cloud. People talk about software as a service. This is you go to the cloud and you're just using an application that somebody else has put up. The last one's really the consumer perspective. I'm consuming some application from the cloud. The first two are really developer perspective or IT pro perspective. How do I build those things that might be SaaS from somebody else's perspective or what IaaS and PaaS are? And I've got a couple slides here just that highlight really the difference between IaaS and SaaS and PaaS. Here's one that in a chart form shows you that as you move from your own dedicated servers all the way over to SaaS, where if, for example, if I get some application, it's a PaaS application that does email, well, I can, if I go to a PaaS provider, I've got a certain amount of control over the scale and the security of that application. But if I consume it as a SaaS app, like using Office 365, for example, that stuff's all handled by somebody else, which may be good from a cost perspective because now I don't have to worry about it. Might not be good from a control perspective because they're doing things a certain way that I might not want to do them. If I go all the way to my own physical hardware where I'm in charge of everything from the bottom to the top, man, I've got total control over what the thing looks like. I can put in specific network switches. I can put in specific operating system software. I can put in particular people that manage that hardware, you know, that might be only from the U.S. or from some other company that I need to have touching that physical hardware for security reasons. So you lose control, but the cost-benefit equation is supposed to be set up such that the efficiencies you gain are because you don't have to worry about all that junk at the bottom that's really, when it comes to a business, people don't really want to worry about. And then as far as infrastructure as a service, this is what you'd have to do if you go to Amazon and set up an application. Let's see, raise a hand, how many people have deployed to Amazon EC2? I'm sure there's a few of you, actually less than I expected. But so you go, you pick your VM out of a library, your VM image. That VM image might be one that has a SQL database in it, probably SQL Server or MySQL. And you're in charge at that point of maintaining the SQL Server database and the SQL MySQL, configuring it to run optimally, maintaining the patches on it. Then you pick another image for your front ends. You pick an Apache Tomcat image, or you pick an IIS image. And now you own that image. Now you're in charge of configuring IIS and configuring the web server and patching it as well. Then you deploy your data, you create your tables, deploy your data to your database, you take your web app and deploy it to the front ends, and then the final step is you configure the load balancer to spray across the instances of your front end that you've deployed. And from that point on, this is where you're managing the thing just like as you were managing them on-premise with your own servers. The PaaS model, which is the Windows Azure model, is you basically say, your application says that it wants a database. You can use a PaaS database, middleware service, SQL Azure, for example. And you say that you want a web VM that's running a web server, IIS. And so those things are provided for you. There's VMs that are running SQL Azure. You deploy your database to those VMs through the programmatic APIs. You create your tables, deploy your data. And then you deploy your web application, and that goes into your web role, as Scott showed you. And you don't have to worry about configuring IIS. You've specified in your service definition, your application definition, how you want it configured. And the configuration happens automatically. The patching happens automatically for you from that point on. And even the load balancer is programmed completely automatically for you. You don't even have to worry about that. So just a simple look at the difference between IIS and PaaS and why we think there's a lot of opportunity in PaaS. We're just at the beginning of defining the primitives that will make it easy for people to write applications, really powerful applications with PaaS. Now I want to transition a little bit and talk about some of the patterns we've seen as we've developed the cloud. And I think it's interesting because as we develop the cloud infrastructure, the cloud infrastructure software, the components, the applications we've got running that manage our cloud are very much like the kinds of applications that people are going to write on the cloud. They have a lot of the same kinds of characteristics. So, for example, the scale. Well, scales for us at the infrastructure might be bigger than most people have to deal with in their applications. But nevertheless, when you go to a cloud computing model, if you're an ISV, you've got some social site, for example, you're probably dealing with scales that haven't been really seen by most applications traditional server place. You've got millions of users in the infrastructure. You might have tens of thousands of users if you're talking about your own application sitting up in the cloud. We've got hundreds of thousands of servers literally in Windows Azure. You might be running your workloads on top of hundreds of servers, dozens at least, more than a lot of traditional data centers have had in them, and small and medium businesses. And then we also have to deal with lots and lots of applications, potentially tens of thousands of applications being deployed to our cloud at the same time. And you might, as part of your own applications, have it broken up into multiple applications that you're deploying and managing. The interesting aspect about the cloud, and this is one where it's just a fact of life. You can't say, no, that's not right. That's not the way it should be. People have to deal with the problems, the challenges that we got to face in trying to make this true is that people expect utility computing from the cloud. When your mobile app is talking to the cloud, you don't want it to give you a message that says cloud service is down for the next 5 hours because of a hardware problem. You don't want to deal with a message that says the cloud's going to be down this Saturday because we're updating the hardware. People expect it to always just be there on and running, just like the electricity. So that means designing an application that can operate and deliver utility-like computing. And that's where the patterns I'm talking about, that how do you build for the kind of scale that you're going to see in the cloud, and how do you design your application to build for the availability expectations people have in the cloud. So let's talk a little bit about scaling for the cloud. There's two ways of scaling, and they're pretty obvious. There's the traditional way of scaling, which is what you do in your own data center. If you've got a SQL server, and that SQL server, you've got one disk on it, you've got a system with a couple cores on it, some RAM on it, and suddenly that SQL server is overwhelmed with the utilization, with demand, the workload that's being put on it. What do? You add some more disks, you add some more RAM. You scale it up, and as the workload gets bigger and bigger, you keep on doing that until you can't do it anymore, and then you go buy a whole new machine. That's your traditional server world, and that's what's pushed Windows Server, for example, to go from supporting 32 processors to 64 processors to 256 processors. Now it supports 2 terabytes of RAM, and those are getting bigger because of people that are in this world, this scale-up world. This is clearly not a sustainable world, and clearly you're not going to be able to get to cloud scales with this model. So the other model is the scale-out model. You start with one server. It's got N cores in it. It's got N disks in it. And if you want more capacity, you stamp out some more of them. The cool thing about the scale-out model is that it gives you a bunch of other benefits. But let's talk first about some of the lessons about scaling out that we've learned. Because obviously in the cloud, we're going to scale out. We're going to scale out with these common building blocks for a few different reasons. We've learned, as we develop for these kinds of scales, that heterogeneity is evil. It's really bad when you want to deal with large-scale systems. The bigger your systems, the more heterogeneity you can have in it. If we had a different type of server for every server we put in Windows Azure, you know, we could operate that way, but our lives would be miserable because every single server then has to be treated specially. What kind of hardware does it have in it? What's the SKU version? So if we want to replace it, how do we go replace it? GFS, our Global Foundation Services, which runs our data centers for use by internal properties, they basically have a menu which lets you be pretty specific about what kind of hardware you want when you're standing up an internal service inside of Microsoft. And that a la carte menu of different server types that has 40 different server types. And this is kind of like going to make Burger King, you can get 40 different types of hamburger. Each one gives you a different flavor of heartburn. And so this is just not the model that we want. We don't want 10,000 different flavors of heartburn in Windows Azure. So one of the things that we've learned, and this is a lesson that actually it's kind of interesting because some of these lessons we end up learning over and over again as we keep making the same mistake in different ways and different places. But one of them is that heterogeneity is really bad. It affects complexity, it affects the manageability of these systems, and the maintainability of these systems. So we want to define our scaling boundaries. Where do we want to scale? What are the areas of the system that should be scalable? And then how do we scale them? What's the unit of scaling? If you take a look at the applications that are going to be running on Windows Azure, very similar to kinds of applications running the infrastructure. Typical N-tier architecture, 3 tiers here. Load balancer on the front, scale out front ends, scale out middle tiers, and then persistent durable storage for the back end. Here's where, as somebody writing an application, and even us, we've got common services for our back end, Windows Azure Storage and SQL Azure, that rocket scientists go write. These things have to be replicated, they have to be transactionally safe, they can't lose data. It's really hard to write one of those things yourself. So we let somebody else write them. Even in Windows Azure, the storage guys write that, and the SQL Azure guys write theirs, and where we can, we take advantage of those services instead of rewriting our own when we want some persistent, durable storage. We focus on the front ends and the middle tiers, and we scale those out, and they're stateless, and that makes our lives a lot easier to make them stateless. When we map that kind of architecture to the Windows Azure application model like Scott did, we map them to different roles, and the roles are scaling boundary. This is defining the role in the application or this tier in the application. What's the code for that? What's the configuration for that? It applies to that whole role, that code and configuration. And then what's our scaling unit for that role? If we want to add more capacity to that role, how do we do that? Well, we add virtual machines in Windows Azure. So you scale out by virtual machines, and you scale out by virtual machines of a particular size. When you get a role, you say this role consists of scaling units of a size of virtual machine that's extra large, which is 8 cores today. So if you want to scale out, you scale out by another 8-core virtual machine. We don't let you scale out by less than an 8-core virtual machine because you know what? The world starts to get really hairy if you've got a role that consists of a 4-core virtual machine, a 2-core, one with 32 gig of memory, one with 12 gig of memory. Instead, we try to help you optimize for homogeneity, and so you scale out by a common unit. Let's talk about high availability now, and this is where things get more interesting, and where actually scale out really helps us as well, because one of the things you get with the scale-out architecture, stateless scale-out, is that no individual server or virtual machine is that important. When you scale out, like that scale-out picture I had of those three machines, if they're scaled out, any one of them can die, and the rest of them can continue operating, as long as they're stateless, of course. And if they're stateful, ideally their data is replicated across all three. You lose one, no big deal, bring back, replace it with another one, and now that guy can join the group and catch up. But the first thing we got to look at when we're designing for availability is what do we mean by availability? And I think this is one of the places where we're very early in the stages of cloud computing for defining this, and we're really not to the point where customers, including people like you that want to write applications, or enterprises with IT pros and CIOs that want to look at the cloud and say, is this really what we need? We're not there yet in really having a good story on SLAs as an industry. But where we are today is we've got very coarse-grained definitions of SLA, which is uptime. And if you look at the nines, that's the traditional way people measure uptimes. Certain number of nines gives you a certain number of minutes or hours you have it contractually to be down before you start refunding people their money for exceeding that. Now, I've got two lines highlighted there. One is 99.9, and that's our storage availability and SQL Azure availability, 99.9, which gives us 8.5 hours a year or 43 minutes of downtime a month. The other one I've got highlighted is 99.95. That is our availability, or SLA availability, for compute, which means that if you've got two instances of any of your roles, two VMs in each of your roles, you've done your part in the SLA contract. If you just have one, you haven't in our model. And the question you might be asking is where did we come up with the 99.95? So when we were coming up with SLAs, this kind of inside story, we sat down for a long time, we discussed, we argued, we debated what should be the 99.95. And then one of the developers said, well, I can solve any problem in less than 20 minutes. And you can see that's where we came up with it. The month there, we can be down for 20 minutes. And so that comes up to 99.95. Now, actually, that's not really the way we did it. We debated, we fought, we argued, and then we went to Amazon's website, and that's what they did, so we did that too. So one of the things we do now, and by the way, the reason that I think that we're really primitive on this is that's just uptime. We say nothing about the performance of our services today, really. In some places we do, but really not enough. And basically, and neither does Amazon, neither does anybody else really talk about SLAs. I think that we're going to be getting to the point where we have to be a lot more precise about every single visible performance aspect of the cloud, not just for availability, but for performance, that is. So we can say for SQL Azure, our SLA is this number of transactions between this number and this number. That's our SLA with you. So that you can look at it and say, how does that compare to what I would get if I had my own SQL server for the same amount of money? And is that performance that SLA gives me good enough for me to consider moving to the cloud? So that's what I mean by we still got work to do there. One of the things about the cloud, though, talking about these scales and having a system that runs this big is that we can't be having people running around fixing problems. The traditional data center in an enterprise, well, you build up this big IT pro staff that loves problems because that justifies their job. If a server fails, that's a crisis. And who's going to be the hero? The IT pros that come in and fix the server. So alerts go up, they go look at the problem, they figure out what needs to be fixed. It's a bad hard disk. They get another hard disk. They stick it in. They get the server booted back up and running and make sure applications are working. If this takes hours or days. We can't, first of all, have IT pros running around data centers with tens of thousands of machines doing this kind of thing. And second, our SLAs can't tolerate that either. So one of the big lessons, of course, just obvious, is that we have to design for failure. We have to assume everything can fail. Every single aspect of the system can fail. not just the hardware, but the software. And if you look at the hardware, this is a place when you run at our scale that statistically speaking, 3 to 5% of every server, of all the servers in our data centers, fail every year. When you have a small number of servers in your own data center, you just buy a few for your own application as a startup, you're not likely to hit that 3 to 5%. You're statistically probably pretty good, and so you might never see a failure, but we definitely do. We see every single kind of failure you can imagine. There was actually one of our data centers. It's about 3 years old, and that's about the lifetime on disks, as if you use disks continuously. It's about 3 years. So the disks in that data center are failing all the time, literally faster than iPhone 4S batteries are dying. And so, had to give it a little jab there. Here's a great story of a particular hardware failure, because when you run at the scale too, you see every single imaginable type of hardware failure. There was a case a few months ago where a few servers in a particular rack were just not getting network traffic. So the racks next to them were getting traffic, other servers in the rack were getting traffic, and it was more than one server. So we knew something funny was going on. It wasn't software because, the rest of the systems were running fine. And it wasn't the network hardware coming down into the rack. It wasn't the top of rack router. It wasn't the particular server. So what could it be? So eventually this got escalated. People worked on it. And we called in the network's operations guys who went and looked. We identified which rack it was and which data center. And they get some guy to go running down to look at what's going on with the cables in that rack. It turns out there were fingerprints on the fiber coming from the top of rack router into the back of the server. They wipe off the fingerprints, and the servers started to get network traffic again. So that's an example of just how bizarre things are. So, and we also try to learn from our mistakes and from those kinds of problems to make sure that they don't happen again. So every morning we have somebody run around and wipe off all the wires in the data center. Now, software also fails, like I said. And the key to tolerating failures are two things. First, detecting them quickly, and second, reacting to them, recovering from the failure quickly. Here's a case where we've got to be able to tolerate failures, to give us time to detect and to react. We build in redundancy everywhere we can. And so you can see in our data center architecture, like many, we've got duplicated resources. We've got duplicated data center routers. We've got duplicated aggregators. We've got duplicated load balancers. So if one fails, we get time to detect it. We get time to fix it, and there's an automatic failover that happens there as well. The one place in the data center that we don't have redundancy built in, and it would be very expensive to build it in, so we decide not to, but rather to design our systems to deal with it, is the top of rack routers. There's just one router in each rack. If that router fails, we lose contact with all the servers in that rack. So this is a place where we've decided, hey, you know what, this is a single point of failure today. Even if we put in duplicate top of rack routers, we might still have another single point of failure in the future. So let's design our application model such that we can have applications deal with single points of failure in our hardware topology. And I don't know if Scott got into this concept of fault domains, but when you write your application, you're given two fault domains. Your application is guaranteed to be spread across two fault domains in the data center, which today means across two racks. Each of your role instances, remember the scaling unit is a VM, that's called an instance of a role. And when you've got a role with multiple instances, here you've got front ends with two, middle tiers with three, they're going to be spread across fault domains. So if one of the racks fails, you still have availability. Your application's not completely down. It's at reduced capacity, so your customers might see sluggishness for a while until what we do is automatically, we call it service healing, and this is where we bring up replacement virtual machines for those instances on other servers that are on a healthy rack. So the outage is going to be, your capacity is going to be down for a few minutes as we get those other virtual machines up, but we spread you across, you can see it spread across more than two, and that's because we try to spread you across at least two. We guarantee two, and ideally we do it across more. The second case where we want to make sure that we stay available is when we're updating our own software. I mentioned you expect your cloud service to be like utility computing. And this is really visible to anybody that's done e-commerce, where you go around surfing the web and you go buy something, and you go to the website to buy it, and it says the site's down for maintenance. The first thing you do, well, people are impatient, you go to somebody else's site and buy from there. So it's whoever's site that was just lost business. We want to make it possible, A, so that we don't say that, hey, Microsoft Cloud's going to be down for the next 12 hours as we do maintenance. We want to make it possible for your apps to not have that problem where you're throwing up maintenance windows in front of people as well. So we've got support in the application model that we use in the infrastructure, as well as make available to you to handle this, and we call it update domains. And we provide two ways for you to update your application. With the update domains, we spread your application across update domains, your instances across update domains. And so when you do an update of your application, or we update the infrastructure underneath you, we honor update domains and only take down one update domain at a time. And that gives you control over the availability of your application for planned operations, like an update. Our updates are yours. Our updates would be include updating the host operating system on our servers in the data center. This gives us an opportunity to do so without, hey, having to tell you that your app's going to be down while we're maintaining the data center. Instead, it's transparent to you if you've designed with update domains in mind. And when you're doing your own planned updates, you give us the updates for the roles. You say, I want the middle tier role to get this updated code or this updated configuration. We'll go and take a slice in one update domain, bring it down, update the code or config, and then start it up, and then wait for that slice to report it's healthy, and then move on to the next one. By default, you get 5 update domains. You can specify up to 20. So really, anywhere between 5 and 20% of your app is what you've got a dial over how much you want to be down during a planned update. Another type of update we've got, I'm just showing this for completeness, is a VIP swap. This is where you can bring up a whole brand new deployment of your application. And at the right time, when you want to flip over, you take the public IP address of your production site and you point it at the new code, the new deployment. And whatever temporary IP address was pointing at the staging code, the one that ready to go into production, gets flipped over to the production one. And now traffic starts flowing into the updated one. So these are the two mechanisms we give you, and we actually make use of both of them in the infrastructure for updates. Another lesson we learn is, again, in designing for failure, assume that there's going to be failures and try to contain the failures at the same time. You'll see this in our data center software architecture, where we've got this concept of clusters, where a cluster is about 1,000 machines, and each of these clusters is managed by an autonomous controller we call the Fabric Controller, the FC. The FC is responsible for provisioning the hardware, so start booting those servers, putting the operating system down on the servers, putting the hypervisor down, and also deploying virtual machines and applications onto those virtual machines. It's really the kernel of the cloud operating system. And we divide it into clusters so that we've got a fault containment. If something goes horribly wrong with the Fabric Controller, it's isolated to 1,000 machines in the data center. It doesn't impact everybody all over the world. We've had a number of cases where this has saved us, this fault isolation. And not just fault isolation, but fault isolation combined with auto recovery shutoff, with caps on the number of healing operations or recovery operations that can happen before we stop and say, wait a minute, something seems to be wrong. We shouldn't be encountering these number of problems, and let's get a human involved. I talked about service healing. This is when the server fails and we start to move those virtual machines, reincarnate them on other servers. If we have too many of the servers move into a bad hardware state, we call it human investigate, then we shut off the service healing and we start flagging critical alerts so that somebody can come and look at the problem. And we had one of these where Windows Deployment Server is what we use in the Fabric Controller to deploy images to these different machines. It's off-the-shelf Windows technology we decided to take advantage of for deployment of images. And one day, Windows Deployment Server got stuck. It hung. We run it at scales that the original Windows Deployment Server guys tested for, literally hundreds or close to 1,000 machines here. where the numbers that they were testing with were literally under 20 or 30, sorry, not machines, images. We run with thousands of images in the Windows Deployment Server repository. They were testing with 10 to 20. So at one point, we are deploying an update to the operating system across the cluster, and Windows Deployment Server hangs. Unfortunately, we hadn't designed to deal with this in an intelligent way. So what happens is the servers that were supposed to get updated start to move into this human investigate mode because they can't pull down their images. And once we hit this threshold of, so we start service healing those, assuming that something's wrong with that server, and moving those VMs onto other VMs. Well, we hit a threshold that we've got built in a failsafe at a certain number, which we learned very early during Windows Azure development to put in this failsafe. After a certain number of servers go into the state, we stop moving servers into that state. We stop healing, doing this movement of reincarnation to stop the whole world from churning because there's a runaway bug. So we call in the guy that's actually, it turns out, just coincidentally, that the guy that was a developer on the WDS team, one of the guys, was a developer on the Fabric Controller team. He gets called in to look at the problem. We're like, how do we get this whole cluster unstuck? He starts to do the investigation, digging through the code, looking at the log files, looking at the source code, and then he comes up and he says, I got it. I got the fix. We say, what is it? He says, reboot the Windows Deployment Server. So we reboot it, and it works. So we learned that even rebooting in the data center is oftentimes the best solution for a problem, just like it is at home, unfortunately. So, and actually what we did in this case was this version of Windows Deployment Server 2008, which we still can run into this problem for, and we're moving to Deployment Server 2008 R2, which is fixed this. But in the meantime, what we do is have the Fabric Controller ping the deployment server to see if it's entered the state, and if it is, it reboots it automatically to get the human out of the picture. Now, inside a cluster, we follow this same pattern. Fabric controllers spread across racks, just like anybody else's application. We spread them across more so that the Fabric controller can actually tolerate a failure while we're doing an update and still have a quorum. It's a stateful service, unlike most of the stateless services. It's a lot like Windows Azure Storage or SQL Azure, where it's got the brain of the cluster, and so we want to make sure that brain stays consistent across different replicas in the Fabric controller, even in the face of a failure, and even in the face of the failure of an update. So that's why we have five instances at the tops of racks maintaining state of the data center, of the cluster. We also designed the system such that even if the Fabric controller completely fails, so it shuts down, that applications continue to run. So wherever we can, we decouple the system as much as we can so that it doesn't depend on things unnecessarily. We said, hey, you know what? Applications running that are deployed to Windows Azure, the only things that the Fabric controller really needs to do is monitor their health and also respond to updates. But if the Fabric controller fails, we'll lose those capabilities, but we shouldn't cause the applications to go down at the same time. So we designed that in as well. But part of dealing with failures is detecting them, and we've got a few different ways we detect failures in the data center as well. One of them is with self-monitoring, where the systems are monitoring themselves to see if they're in a healthy state. An example is just what I told you, the Windows Deployment Server ping to see if it's healthy. We also have external monitoring. We also have this canary service, an example of external monitoring, where there's an actual Windows Azure application deployed in every single rack of every single cluster of every single data center, has virtual machines, extra small virtual machines in every one of these, that are talking to everybody else in their racks in the same cluster. They're also talking to the load balancers, seeing if they can talk to them. And they're also talking to Microsoft.com and to random racks in a neighboring cluster and in a cluster across in a pairwise data center. So we've got these things running all the time, emitting output and basically testing the network, and the connectivity of the network, as well as the health of the compute across the system as well at the same time. That's our operations room, which is in Building 109, which is just down the street. On the third floor, you can see the heads-up displays, and you can see the canary display. I've got the screenshot of here up in the far right as those guys are watching out for problems. There's also a redundant version of this Operation Center 2 in India, just in case something happens to this one. Now, one of the aspects of the system is monitoring the health of the system as well and responding to the health of the system. The Windows Deployment Server reboot is an example, but there's a bunch of places in the system that we've got automated monitoring for problems and automated recovery for problems. And they include everything from looking for servers that have failed because they won't boot, to looking to see if a VM has crashed because somebody's got code in it that's buggy, that's caused their own VM to crash, and restarting those automatically. Example of a case where we had a real live incident, didn't have the right fault detection in place that showed up in production was in a VM crashing before the customer's code got started, actually before the VM got started. So we had this one situation where we had a customer call in, say that their application was down. We went and looked at it. They had two instances. They were updating the configuration of it, and they'd screwed up their configuration such that one instance has been updated, but it was no longer working properly, and the second one was stuck in a reboot, saying the system was rebooting it, starting it. So we had our operations guys go look at it, that machine that was stuck, and they found that what was happening was the server was booting, getting the virtual machine ready to start, trying to start the virtual machine, and then spontaneously rebooting because of a hardware problem. So that was a case where decided to do in that situation was detect the number of times that the server had rebooted ungracefully, spontaneously rebooted, and then moving that machine into the human investigate mode, which would cause healing of the machines off that. Another lesson is asynchronous loose coupling. Instead of sending a request to a specific instance, send it to any of them. And instead of waiting a response, go about your business and do other things. This is simply async programming. If you get the tight coupling here between a front end and a worker, and that coupling fails, well, it becomes hard to recover from that. So what we do is promote a queue-based model where the front end sticks a message in a queue. Any of the workers can pick it up. If that worker dies while it's in the middle of processing it, the queue message will reappear in the queue because the worker actually has just taken a lease on it. And if it doesn't delete the message within a certain amount of time, that it determines is the average amount of time it takes for it to process this request, then the message shows up again in the queue, and now another worker can pick it up. The front end didn't have to worry about it. The queue did basically all the fault recovery there, and that's a mechanism built into Windows Azure. And finally, let's talk a little bit about how we develop and test. So we test as much as we can. We learn testing early catches, the standard software engineering lesson that you learn, which is if you catch bugs early, they cost a lot less. So we test in the dev's box. We've got an environment. It's a clusters. Clusters called the integration clusters, where when code has been deemed to be ready to go into pre-production, we toss it in with everybody else's pre-production code, and we run our big unit tests on there and functional tests on there. And you can see a schedule here that we've got a loosely coupled development model where every team can go at its own pace. We release early, and this is actually one of the lessons too. Release frequently. Each team releases its own cadence, decides what frequency is. Some release every 4 weeks, some every 6 weeks, some every 2 months. And if you can, try to make it one big feature in each release so that if something goes wrong, you're focused on fixing it in that one big feature, not trying four different features. And that actually forces you into release frequently because you've got big features coming in all the time, so you want slots for them to go in independently of each other. This is actually the release pipeline snapshot from an email that comes out every day out of our release lab. You can see different features or components of the Windows Azure infrastructure. Moving from integration, you can see it's about a week inside of the integration is what we estimate in most cases. When it comes out of that, it goes into a bake environment, which is kind of where it sits, and we run some other tests on it, but it sits for a while. And then if it survives that without any problems, then we put it into production. And then finally, our DevOps. This is something that you've been hearing a lot about lately, is this new DevOps model of the world, certainly required in a cloud computing model or a services model of the world, where the developer is not just making a product, handing it off to test, tests it, says it's good, gives it to the publishing people. They burn the DVDs or CDs and then publish it, and you rinse, lather, repeat on a 3-year cycle. Here, we're constantly releasing. The software is very fresh, and problems are very real to us or to whoever's operating the service, and so the developers have to be on call to handle incidents. That case I told you about, the virtual machines rebooting, that was actually a live-side incident. Happened to one of these guys, got called in by the live-site guys, said, here's a problem, we haven't seen this before. Can you investigate it? He investigated, that's when he saw the virtual machine rebooting, and manually moved that node into human investigate, and then filed a bug with the developers so that we could get a fix in the next release to deal with that particular situation. So it's a very iterative cycle, and actually this is kind of also promotes good testing for developers, because when you're on call, you're not just on call for your own stuff, but for the guys next door too, and the guys down the hall that are part of the same feature team. So if you get woken up at 4 in the morning for the guy down the hall's problem, you're probably going to want to say something to him on Monday morning, right? So that brings me to the conclusion. I have a bunch more stories that I wish I could share to you, but I'm actually over time, and Keith's hovering over there, so I'm going to have to wrap it up.
Well, you can bring all those stories back next year.
All right, I'll do that.
Okay.
So thanks very much, and I hope you found this useful and maybe took away some tips for building your own scalable, available apps.
Thank you.